economy of $600 billion. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Press TV noted, Iranians and Africans have traded since times immemorial, the testimony of which is the many inhabitants of the Swahili coast and the nearby Indian Ocean islands of Zanzibar, Pemba, and Comoros, generally known as the Shirazi people. Modern Swahili people have an oral history embracing both African and Asian roots, including one text which traces the founding of Tanzania's Kilwa to the arrival of a Persian prince. The self-governing island of Zanzibar in Tanzania, apart from bearing a Persian name, has preserved numerous traces of its historical links with Iran. Many of its residents, based on oral tradition, are descendants of Iranian merchants from Shiraz, who directly settled various mainland ports and islands on the Eastern Africa seaboard beginning in the 10th century in an area between Mogadishu, Somalia in the north and Sofala in the south. A study of centuries-old DNA published in the prestigious journal Nature in March estimated that people of African and Persian ancestry began to have children together in the Swahili coast region around the year 1000 AD. Iran, after 1979 Islamic Revolution, embarked on renewing relations with the African people based on Islam's prohibition of racism. The current leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, paid 6 state visits to Africa during his 2 4-year terms as Iran's president, when the country was in a war imposed by the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. The policy of strengthening relations with Africa continued during the terms of the next Iranian presidents, who paid 41 visits to Africa in total. Trade between Iran and Africa increased between 2005 and 2006, but the global financial crisis and cruel sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic under a UN Security Council resolution in 2007 decimated it. Surveys show Iran's trade with Africa has remained subdued at about $1.2 billion over the past few years, during which no significant step was taken to restore economic relations. That is going to change, according to the Director General of the Africa Office of Iran Trade Development Organization, who expects Tehran's trade with Africa to hit $10 billion in the next 3 years. Africa is home to 18% of the world's population, with an increasing population growth. It is a vital region with some of the fastest-growing economies in the world, where countries are now more stable and predictable places to live, work, and build businesses. Africa is rich in natural resources ranging from arable land, water, oil, natural gas, minerals, forests, and wildlife. It is home to some 30% of the world's mineral reserves, including 40% of the world's gold and up to 90% of its chromium and platinum. The largest reserves of cobalt, diamonds, platinum, and uranium in the world are in Africa, which also holds 65% of the world's arable land and 10% of the planet's internal renewable freshwater source. According to Mehrad Ebad, a member of Tehran Chamber of Commerce, Africa's foreign trade has grown significantly in the last 20 years, but Iran has not been able yet to use the capacity. He told Mizan News Agency, that said, The African market still remains virgin territory, and Iran can stake out a share of this market. In Abbad's words, the lack of proper presentation of the African market to Iranian businessmen and economic entrepreneurs is one of the reasons why Iran is lagging behind other countries in the continent. Another reason is the cruel sanctions. For exports to Africa, Iranian traders have to send their goods through neighboring countries such as the UAE, Oman, and Turkey, which entails in re-exports and higher export costs. To increase trade and relationship with African countries, Iran should activate joint chambers of commerce in order to introduce target markets and existing risks, because Iranian exporters generally have little knowledge about the continent. Africa is a safe and low-risk destination for Iranian traders, with a market for minerals, oil and gas, nano and food products such as pistachio and saffron, as well as polymers, petrochemicals, and technical engineering services. Meanwhile, there is ample capacity in Iran for shipment of goods to African countries by sea, which is the most affordable way to move products all around the world and suited to many business types. One of the remarkable upsides of Iranian trade with African countries is the distance factor. The distance between Iran and Africa is much shorter than between, let's say, China and Africa. This is a significant advantage which Iran can use to increase trade with the African continent. President Raisi's visit to Africa is on track to enhance Iran's economic and political relations and pave the way for development of trade exchanges that will benefit the private sector most. Exporters and owners of private businesses have tagged along with President Raisi's delegations in his recent foreign visits. According to Abbad, one of the solutions is to increase and embolden the private sector's role in foreign trade and the accompaniment of private enterprises in the president's foreign visits will benefit Iran's economy at the end of the day. African markets are diverse, and buying power is growing among consumers across the continent. Iranian economists say the country can carve out a niche with proper planning, emphasizing the role of the private sector and developing joint chambers of commerce. Iran's trade with different African countries is varied. It has had good economic success with the eastern countries of the continent, such as Kenya and Tanzania, but not as much in many others. It is time to unleash capacities at full throttle, increasing exports, offering technical and engineering services, and investing in some projects which would mutually benefit both parties and build new bridges between their nations.
At the start of World War II, both the Axis and Allied forces had poisonous shells. A total 50,965 tons of poisonous agents were deployed by both sides of the conflict, including chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas. Official figures declare about 1.3 million casualties directly caused by chemical warfare agents during the course of the war. Yet the end of the war was not the end of chemical weapons. They were dumped into the dark and deadly depths of the oceans. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. From 1917 to 1970, the armies of the world's greatest powers systematically dumped 1 million tons of chemical weapons into our oceans. A military secret so well kept that underwater dump sites remain hidden for several decades. This week's program investigates this untold story of global chemical pollution, which threatens our health, environment, and economy. These deadly poisons are leaking little by little into the sea, threatening fishermen, bathers, fish, and the entire ecosystem. Stay with us for the first part of the program.
I found a report that detailed the movement of chemical weapons from depots and storage areas in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, that noted that some chemical weapons were disposed of at sea.
If you look at the lake, I mean, everybody's first response is, there's no munitions here. I can't see them. I see this beautiful lake. How can you have munitions? Reality, they're there, and we're paying a price for them.
Time bombs are ticking under the sea. 1 million tons of unused chemical weapons lie on seabeds all over the world, and their contents are leaking. This is an unknown story that cutting-edge science and newly declassified documents are now bringing to light.
Chemical weapons in various forms have a very ancient lineage, but their main military usage has derived from the First World War, where they're used in very substantial quantities. The first major gas attack of any significance was the use of chlorine gas during the First World War across a 6 kilometer front at the Second Battle of Ypres, launched on 22nd of April 1915. Other gases are introduced, but the big breakthrough is in 1917 when mustard gas is used for the first time and it becomes known as the king of the war gases.
The new weapons attacked the body inside and out. First affected were the eyes with a severe burning sensation. Then there would be a painful swelling of the lids, followed quickly by blindness, sometimes permanent, caused by ocular clouding. The lungs were assaulted on a cellular level, prompting coughing, bleeding, blistering of tissue, resulting in respiratory distress, pulmonary edema, and death up to 10 days after exposure. The most noticeable effects were on the skin, where red lesions appeared before erupting into raised blisters filled with yellow liquid, severely painful to the touch.
The interwar period is a very strange period for chemical warfare. Most of the programs are secret, and the intelligence agencies know very little about the extent and depth and the innovations. And like intelligence agencies the world over, that when you don't know the truth, you assume the worst.
This is a new arsenal started at the beginning of the present emergency. It is now in production and can manufacture more mustard gas in one day than was manufactured by us in all of World War I.
The Americans acquire eventually something like 51 million chemical shells, or 1 million chemical bombs, 100,000 spray tanks ready for a chemical war. I mean, their production is colossal, 135,000 tons of gas.
The chemical war that everyone was expecting never took place. At the Potsdam Conference, the victorious Allies decided to split up the enemy's stocks and dump them in the seas. This was considered the safest alternative at the time, and they imposed official secrecy on this policy until 2008. Dumpings took place all over the world, in the Sea of Japan, the Indian Ocean, the Baltic Sea, the North Sea, the North Atlantic, and off the Côte d'Azur in France. Our investigation began in Italy with sea dumping in the Mediterranean. Those dumpings were unknown by the public until Gianluca Defoe, a reporter from Milan, broke the story in his best-selling book, Poisons of State. Documents uncovered by Defoe revealed never-before-known details of how chemical weapons from both sides in the war ended up in the sea. As far as the Italian weapons are concerned, on the Allied side, it was a daring air raid that brought their chemical weapons to the seas. On December 2nd, 1943, the German Luftwaffe bombed the port of Bari, and it unknowingly provoked the biggest chemical disaster in the Mediterranean. The Allies kept secret their chemical weapons shipment for fear of handing the Nazis a huge propaganda victory. This secrecy hindered efforts to effectively treat hundreds of Italian citizens affected when a cloud of sulfur mustard gas wafted over the city. We find a similar situation in the north of Europe and the Baltic Sea. During the Second World War, it was a theater of combat for the navies of Germany, Finland, and the Soviet Union. The Baltic is today, without doubt, considered the most polluted sea in the world. Cold War politics were a major obstacle to the scientific study of the effects of chemical munitions in the Baltic. With the fall of the USSR, Baltic states were now free to do the work. The Polish Academy of Science began ChemSea.
We are 11 institutions all around the Baltic Sea. Countries like Sweden, Finland, Germany, Lithuania and Poland. Now the Baltic Sea bottom become a resource. There are more and more pipelines, windmills, cables and so on being laid on the sea bottom. So it's not really safe to proceed without better knowledge. We are basically performing a risk assessment for the dumped munitions from the Second World War, which resides on the Baltic Sea bottom. And we are trying to assess the location of munition, the pollution of the bottom around it, and the impact it might have on the ecosystem. We are at the Bornholm Deep dump site. It's the biggest single dump site in the Baltic Sea. It's about 30,000 tons of munitions dumped here. They believed if we dump it in the Bornholm Deep, when we've got muddy sediments, it will not propagate to other areas of the Baltic because they thought it is totally inert area. No bottom currents, no water movement. It will stay where it is dumped. Nowadays, we know that the salt water which comes from the North Sea travels through this area and is moved to other areas of the Baltic. So if the sediments are contaminated, it can be a point source of contamination which is spreading to other areas in the Baltic. We decided to collect sediments very close to the objects, like half a meter if possible, and we can only do it with the robot, because with the robot we can take sediment samples which will be most probably contaminated with mustard gas or any other warfare agents. Sometimes you are seeing the encasements which are completely corroded and the actual agent sits on the bottom in lumps. It's leaking into the environment. We do not know the speed of leakage because some objects are completely intact and some of them are completely corroded. And it seems that sea is degrading it to more stable forms, but some of those more stable forms are equally toxic as original agents, whereas the master gas decomposes to thioglycol, which can be hydrolyzed completely in the seawater to sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, so it's pretty much harmless substances, whereas those compounds which were based on arsenic oil, they are decomposing to inorganic arsenic, finally. And arsenic is, of course, a poison. We launched like three expeditions now to the dumping sites, collecting fish, cod mainly. And what we have seen is the higher frequency of fish diseases and also some impact on the genotoxicity, because those compounds are highly mutagenic. So our partners from Lithuania were able to see the mutated blood cells. We didn't yet, at least, detect toxic levels of arsenic in tissue, whereas we've been able to detect the arsenic in urine of fish. So it seems that it's affecting the fish health, but actually not to the extent which makes it dangerous to consumption. There are many pollutants in the environment which can cause similar effects, like organic contaminants, heavy metals, and so on. So it seems that chemical munitions are maybe not a single factor, but a factor which enhances the environmental damage.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive.
Can you load in there?
We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. But that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms. The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s of barrels and barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard the military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball, laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't had any idea where they would be.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
Baltic Sea fishermen face continuing threats that dangerous bombs or leaked substances will be caught in their nets. Bornholm Island, a Danish island, is in the middle of the Baltic, close to one of the largest dump sites.
I'm fifth generation fisherman on Bornholm. And we have manual, so we can have to deal with this. We have areas where there are dumped chemicals, weapons. The yellow one is a precautionary area, and the red is where we should be extra careful. And you have Bornholm here, you have the Baltic, Gotland in Sweden, and also an area, and a red area for extra precaution.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
فدعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآني
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد
وآل محمد وأجل فرجه Welcome back. Thank you so much for being with us, respected brothers and sisters, especially brothers here, Minhal Hussein, especially. And most importantly, Mahdi Al-Husseinan.
Yeah.
And most importantly,
not
Hadi,
him.
And
not,
most importantly,
not
me.
Not.
Sorry. Okay. So let's go. We were practicing, Alhamdulillah, Suratul Inshiqaq. Okay, one question. Suratul Inshiqaq.
Suratul Inshiqaq.
How do you read it?
Suratul
Inshiqaq. Al Inshiqaq. Great. The rule that we just mentioned here was whenever we have Alif Maddi, yeah. then we have a word starting with yeah. Hamzatul Wasl.
Yes?
What do we have to do?
We connect it.
We connect them together. We join them together. We do not prolong the sound of Alif Maddi.
Like Iza Sama.
Yeah, Iza Sama. Iza Sama. Right?
Yes.
Okay, we were practicing this. In ayah, we were just
six.
On ayah 6, right?
Yes.
So let's practice from the beginning and continue to ayah 6, then inshallah we'll continue the rest of the surah. A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim.
Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
Bismillahir rahmanir rahim.
إذا السماء انشقت
إذا السماء انشقت
وأذنت لربها وحقت
وأذنت لربها وحقت
وإذا الأرض مدت
وإذا الأرض مدت
وألقت ما فيها وتخلت
وألقت ما فيها وتخلت
ما فيها ما فيها
وألقت ما فيها وتخلت وألقت ما فيها وتخلت
وأذنت لربها وحقت
وأذنت لربها وحقت
يا أيها الإنسان
يا أيها الإنسان
إنك كادح إلى ربك
إنك كادح إلى ربك
كدحا فملاقيه
كدحا فملاقيه
Okay, so the next ayah, right? Who wants to read?
Me.
Okay.
No, Hadi. My homeless. I heard my homeless said he wanted to read.
Okay, inshallah, the next time.
فَأَمَّا مَنْ أُوتِيَ إِلَى كِتَابَهُ
Okay, one question. Do we have any... Read it again.
There's no...
You just added one word.
Yeah, إلى. He added the la.
Oh, okay.
فَأَمَّا مَنْ أُوتِيَ إِلَى
No, where is إِلَى
from?
إِلَى
مَنْ آمَنَ
Where's Ila?
Oh, Ila, so I
That's the other line.
فَأَمَّا مَنْ أُوْتِيَ كِتَابَهُ بِيَمِينِهِ
أحسن فَأَمَّا مَنْ أُوْتِيَ كِتَابَهُ بِيَمِينِهِ
فَأَمَّا مَنْ
What does Allah Almighty say? That in the day of resurrection, okay, in the day of resurrection, in the day of Qiyamah, the day of judgment. So the one who is given the book, his book, okay,
is
the right hand. Yamin means the right hand, okay?
Yeah.
Either you take it with the right hand, they give it to the right hand,
or the left hand.
So what does it mean? It does not mean that they certainly give you the book to the right hand. Take it with your right hand, or take it with your left hand. What does it mean? When in the day of result announcement at school, when they give you the results, do they give you to the right hand or the left hand?
Both right hand, Quran.
Doesn't matter which hand you take it, okay?
You know, for
Sir,
example...
you breathe with this or this
you
nose.
You don't lie.
It doesn't matter.
You breathe with
you
both.
You breathe with both.
Yeah.
You breathe with one, or just one, you die from
remember?
From no air.
In the day of judgment, okay? Either you... In the Quran, it's mentioned this way, okay? It's given to the right hand or
the left hand.
So it does not mean right, left, right hand or left hand. Exactly. Okay? It might mean this way, that they will give you the book. I mean, they will show you the results of what you have done in this world. So this result, either it will make you happy or sad.
If it's black, it will go in this.
They have figuratively used the right hand and left hand.
Right for good.
Yeah, right for good and happy result. Left for bad and
there are two,
not
like,
good results.
Sorry, if someone don't have left hand.
If someone
I told
have
you, it doesn't
right
mean
leg.
That hand, this hand, okay, there.
Sir, there are two angels here. What are their names?
The angels?
Yeah.
One name of the angel is Minhal, the other one is Muhammad Yahya.
Sir, okay. That one that write the bads, it's on the left, and that one write goods.
Sorry,
they're
okay?
So heavy because I'm tired.
No,
I'm يبكي يسأل خالقه فأتاه الوحي فأشرق اقرأ اقرأ
Let's recite the Quran.
اقرأ بسم ربك الذي خلق.
So let's get back to the Quran. Okay, فأما من أوتي كتابه بيمينه.
Can I read the other yet?
Yes, read Muhammad Mahdi. Muhammad Mahdi or just Mahdi? Just Mahdi, right?
Yes.
Mahdi Jasab Abdul Karim Al Husseinan.
No, it's actually not my name. It's my dad's name. Jasab Abdul Karim Al Husseinan is my dad's name.
Mahdi Husseinan Jasab Abdul Karim.
No, my name is Mahdi Al Husseinan only.
Okay, Mahdi Al Husseinan only. His name is Mahdi Al Husseinan only.
Mahdi Al Husseinan only. Mahdi Al Husseinan only.
What is
okay, Mr. Only, read.
You said.
Fasofa, yeah.
Read.
Okay, yeah, please just. Don't
talk recite.
To my
you
mind.
Like, they love you to recite because they love your voice.
No, I'm really tired. That's only in the time of 12 o'clock.
Okay,
فَسَوْفَ يُحَاسِبُ حِسَابًا يَسِيرًا.
Okay. So, Mahdi, whenever you see tanween, okay?
يَسِيرًا.
No, you see tanween, حِسَابًا. Yeah? Do you see there?
Oh,
okay.
Hisaban yasira.
Or wow, you see. Hisaban. Okay.
Hisaban yasira.
Now say it. Hisaban yasira.
Hisaban yasira.
Don't forget this, okay?
Yeah.
We'll talk about that, inshallah. And level
is it
three? And level three, inshallah, yeah.
Yeah, if it's you read so like how this. So how are you supposed to know this?
So
how are you supposed to know this if it's level three?
فَسَوْفَ يُحَاسَبُ حِسَابًا يَسِيرًا
فَسَوْفَ يُحَاسَبُ حِسَابًا يَسِيرًا
فَسَوْفَ يُحَاسَبُ
حِسَابًا يَسِيرًا
وَيَنْقَلِبُ Because it's the last word.
I already explained this.
Okay,
it
right.
It cut. Everybody knows.
Inshallah, we'll talk about it, okay?
Everyone knows?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh. It means you have learned that you know.
Yeah.
If you know, it means you have learned it.
Yes.
Great. So, إِنَّهُ كَانَ
إِنَّهُ كَانَ
فِي أَهْلِهِ مَسْرُورًا
فِي أَهْلِهِ مَسْرُورًا
Okay. So, that's enough. Because we have now understood that we have, whenever we have Alif Maddi, then Hamzatul Wasl.
It's been 3 weeks we've been learning the
Hamzatul Wasl.
Yes.
It is very important.
3 weeks.
You know, we have more, you know, Mahdi, you know, we have more things to say about it, but we don't talk about it here anymore, okay? We'll just finish it now, okay? In this session, and I told you, the next session, we will start talking about how to make a pause or how to stop whenever we read an ayah, okay? So, because Hamzatul Wasl has a lot of things to be discussed, okay? Like, for example, how should we understand that this word is a verb, this word is a noun? How should we understand? These things are kind of difficult, okay? But we don't need to talk about them because you don't know anything about verbs. In Arabic, it's difficult, okay? No problem, inshallah. You will know step by step, okay? You just need to kind of compare them, okay, to one another.
If it has L, it's noun.
Verb is if it verb has or this?
Yeah. Alif Lam, it's noun. That's if noun. It don't have Lam, it's verb.
No. Sometimes it does not have Alif Lam, it's not verb, it's noun.
Sir, verb is like this. Zarabu.
That's verb, yes. but Zarabu, 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 they do not start with Hamzatul Wasl.
Yes.
The imperative one starts with Hamzatul Wasl.
Oh, yes, I know this.
Okay.
My father teach me.
So remember, okay? Mahdi, remember if you see imperatives, like idhrib, it means hit him. Or some other verbs like this, okay, they are verbs. Imperative, and they start with Hamzatul Wasl. Thank you so much. Inshallah, we'll get back. But before that, let's recite a Quranic salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به
هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن.
The pain industry. Part 1.
Karl Lagerfeld passed away on February 19, 2019. He was one of the most famous fashion designers in the world, and the news of his death became the headlines of European newspapers and news agencies all around the world. Of course, the news of the death of this German fashion designer who lived most of his life in France was not the only important issue of those days. Reporters and journalists soon reported that Karl Lagerfeld had made a strange will. Having no heirs, he left a great amount of his fortune to his pet, a cat called Choupette. A little later, the French news agency estimated that this considerable wealth is more than 3 million euros and will be used for the greater welfare of Choupette. Now Choupette has two mates, a bodyguard, and several popular pages on social media. It seems that Choupette has been able to make the animated theme of the Aristocats a reality. Although she is known as the richest and most famous cat in the world, it must be said that she is not the only animal that has managed to attract attention. Other species of animals have managed to be in the center of human attention in recent years, although not as much as Choupette. Numerous reports that are published from various competitions and events related to animals from all over the world prove that having pets is not specific to a particular geography, but an important and comprehensive issue in developed countries. This news is sometimes about a pet grooming salon in Taiwan that has many customers. Sometimes it is dedicated to the news coverage of the annual selection of the world's ugliest dog. A popular competition with a prize of $1,500 is held annually in Petaluma, California, among recently rescued street dogs. Of course, these events are sometimes so strange that the reader of these news is astonished. There are events like the annual dog surfing competition in California's Del Mar Beach, an architectural exhibition for pet dogs in London, and of course a priest's blessing of pets in Lima, Peru, and hundreds of other annual events in every corner of the world. The large number of these types of competitions and strange events, which have become the topic of discussion among animal advocates in recent years, may raise the important question of when humans became interested in raising and keeping animals. Archaeological findings and the oldest murals left by mankind prove that more than 15,000 years have passed since the domestication of animals by humans. It seems that the first cases of domestication of animals were with the aim of using them for a better life. Dogs were domesticated to protect humans from predators, cats to hunt vermin and guard granaries, cows and sheep to produce dairy, horses to transport goods and passengers, and pigeons to send letters. Of course, this type of domestication, which was sometimes accompanied by violence, was more common among the normal people than among the nobles and the rich. The only social class that raised and kept animals for fun in those days were the gentles and the rich. This process took a serious form with the arrival of the 17th and 18th centuries in Europe. Signs of domesticated animals that were raised for fun and pastime can be found in a large number of paintings from the past centuries. Paintings that were commissioned by the rich and powerful ones to reflect their way of life. In the beginning of the 20th century and the industrialization of life, the use of animals in daily life underwent extensive changes. On the one hand, with the progress of science, scientists were able to create genetic changes in some animals, such as dogs, and use them for special purposes. And on the other hand, increasing the welfare level of more people had made keeping pets a hobby. Now, the lifestyle of the aristocrats and rich people of the past centuries had spread to the life of the newly emerging middle class in Europe and the US. Having a pet had become a normal subject in their lives. By the second half of the 20th century, having a pet turned into an epidemic. It was rare to find a family in the United States of America that did not want to keep pets. With the beginning of the 21st century, owning a pet reached a high history. According to the research of Walpole Institute, in the United States, every American child asks his parents for a pet 11 times a month. For years, some anthropologists and, of course, a large number of animal rights advocates have tried to analyze the reasons for the growing interest of humans in having pets in the modern lifestyle. Some of these people have said that the vulnerability and pitiful nature of some animals have attracted human attention, and others believe that keeping pets can be reminiscent of keeping children. We shall consider the fact that the responsibility of raising a child is much more than keeping a pet. According to the report of the American Pet Products Association, more than 93% of dog and cat owners in the United States stated that emotional connection, spiritual attachment, and of course entertainment are the most important reasons for keeping pets. An interest that may have been intensified by the childlike appearance of bulldogs or pugs or other animals such as cats or rabbits. Of course, paying too much attention to some species and keeping them by humans has become more extreme in recent years. The large number of websites that offer pet-related products shows that Class differences and luxury have arisen not only among humans, but also among animals. There are strange products such as vitamin supplementation and herbal medicines to reduce anxiety, smart toys, sleep aids, shampoos, waxes, hot tubs, perfume, and a variety of clothing for special occasions. Of course, the extent of this extreme attention to animals liked by humans is not limited to these internet websites. The exhibition that is held annually in a large number of countries to supply this type of products is another wonder of this field. Now they call all of it the pet industry. One of the most famous of these exhibitions is the annual event of Disneyland in Florida, United States of America. It is a famous exhibition in an area equal to 13 football pitches and with the presence of more than 5,000 companies producing products related to pets. In the numerous booths of this exhibition, strange, diverse, and expensive products are offered, including cosmetics, jewelry, furniture, sunglasses, diapers, and psychotherapeutic drugs for pets. So visitors choose these products according to their taste. Considering the presence of pets in the homes of 63% of Americans, their great interest in this exhibition is not so strange. Their interest in products related to pets has increased the value of the pet industry in the United States to $40 billion a year. This is a significant number that has doubled compared to 1994. However, the variety of these flashy, showy, and unnecessary products raises serious questions about animal welfare concerns. But the owners of this industry have a different opinion about this issue. They consider it necessary to buy and use these goods, and citing researches that have not yet been verified, they emphasize that keeping animals not only reduces stress and improves the lives of humans, but also helps to improve the conditions of the animals themselves. A questionable opinion that has been proven to be incorrect according to some evidence. Another aspect of keeping pets, according to some researchers, is that some animal species cannot attract humans' attention due to purely external reasons. More precisely, human attention to some animals and lack of attention to others has caused the life of less popular animals to be in danger.
IRIB English Radio.